It's time for The Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly conversation about bicycles, cyclists, trails, travel, advocacy, the bike industry, and much, much more. You can subscribe to our weekly podcast at OutspokenCyclist.com or through your favorite podcatching app to listen anytime. Now here's your host, Diane Jenks.
Hello and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks, and this is our show for March 12th, 2022. This week's show first takes us way back in history with one of the most decorated cyclists of his time, and then brings us up to date with one of our favorite guests and one of the most prominent frame builders working today. My first guest is Keisha Tandy. Keisha is the curator of social history at the Indiana State Museum in Indianapolis. Last Saturday, March 5th, a new exhibit opened at the museum, delving deeply into the life of Marshall Major Taylor. Subtitled Fastest Cyclist in the World, Keisha walks us through the exhibit and what we can expect to see and do. Then we're going to head to Connecticut to catch up with Richard Sachs. This conversation begins with a chat about an interview Richard gave to Tempest Fugit, a site run by a watch guy named James Henderson. So what does Richard, Henke, as Mr. Henderson's friends call him, and fine watches have to do with one another? Well, you'll learn all about it and more in a bit. When you think of icons of the racing world, from Jacques Anquetil and Eddy Merckx to champions like Davis Finney and Mark Cavendish, you may not always think back to remember one of the most famous of them all, Marshall Major Taylor. There have been countless stories, articles, and books about Major Taylor, so when I learned about this new exhibit in Indianapolis, I wondered what would be different and maybe new. Well, actually, it turns out that there is a lot. From his diary and other personal writings, to his trophies and other memorabilia, curator Keisha Tandy walks us through the extensive areas of the exhibit to show us what Major Taylor's life was all about. Hello, Keisha. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for being my guest this week. How are you?
I am well. Thank you so much for inviting me.
It is my pleasure, one of my listeners, and I get so many great guests because of my listeners. Mark Allen, who is part of your organization, suggested I talk to you about a new exhibit at the State Museum of Indiana. Tell us a little bit about your role as curator.
So I am the curator of social history. So I spend a lot of time researching people, places, and things that help to tell the story about the history of Indiana. I spend a lot of time in repositories, reviewing online collections, going out to meet with individuals who would like to donate materials to the museum, and just then being able to share that information with individuals, as well as doing a lot of research.
Well, it sounds like an interesting job.
Yes.
What's your background?
I have a degree in history and a master's in library science. So spending time in libraries and repositories is actually a lot of fun for me.
It's a lot of fun for a lot of people I know. So what was the impetus to mount an exhibit about Major Taylor? And what was his connection to Indiana? Of course, everybody in the bicycle world who is familiar with racing especially, knows who Major Taylor was, but there are a lot of listeners who may not.
Okay. So Major Taylor was born in Indianapolis, Indiana, November 26, 1878. So he is very important to the history of the state and in the history of Indianapolis. And we actually have his collection here at the Indiana State Museum. He and his wife, Daisy Victoria, had one child, Rita Sidney Taylor Brown. And in 1988, she donated the collection to the museum. And this collection is a significant collection. It really helps to chronicle his story. And he used many of the materials to help write his autobiography that was published in 1928. And within this collection, we have 9 scrapbooks. And the scrapbooks are extremely detailed. They include numerous articles, and newspaper clippings from throughout his time racing. In addition, there are different cards, there were some photographs, and they're just different pieces that really help to put together his story. There are photographs. There are two trophies. They are both from 1901 as he was racing in Europe then and on his way to becoming an international superstar. There are letters, and the letters are from 1909. And this was one of his last points of racing, his last tour. And in those letters, you get a true sense of Major Taylor as we all know him as a champion cyclist, but we get a true sense of looking at him as the devoted father and husband. And he talks in these letters, sending great love to his family, but also you get a lot of information about his training, when he is waking up, when he is going to bed, how he feels about racing at this point, the competitors and different tactics and how he is going about just racing. And even to the point where he talks about putting on layers of clothing because the weather is cold. And throughout different parts of the collection, he does talk a lot about weather because that's so important to his cycling and him being able to train. And as many of your listeners will know, training was so important to him. There are also several postcards, and the postcards are very sweet, and they also help to chronicle where he is going. He was an international superstar and he was traveling all over. And so we have postcards from many different places, from Paris. We have those things. And it's really interesting also because while he was in Paris, we have these two envelopes that are part of the exhibit. There's just the Major Taylor, his name, and like one says, 1 mile bicycle king. So he had such notoriety that you can put these distinct markers about Major and people would know who he was. And so that, you know, using the collection as kind of the foundation allowed us to really tell a great story of his life using materials that he actually used to write his own story.
Let me take a moment to reintroduce you. We're speaking with Keisha Tandy. She is the curator of state history, the State Museum of Indiana in Indianapolis. We're talking about a new exhibit that actually opens today, March 5th. How long does the exhibit run, Keisha?
The exhibit runs through October 23rd.
Good to know. And so one of the things that all my listeners know, I send some talking points ahead of time, but one of the things that I didn't send until you started talking, and I didn't ask you, but he spent a lot of time in Europe because of discrimination and bigotry here in the US against him as a Black cyclist. So he was welcomed in Europe and he was a king over there when it came to cycling. Is there any relationship between the kind of treatment he received here in this country and mounting the exhibit at this time?
So this exhibit, we talk a lot about how Major describes it. He talks about in his autobiography that dreadful monster prejudice. And we do focus in one area of the exhibit, just really looking at some of the treatment that he received, you know, recounting one experience where he was almost choked unconscious, you know, the different rivalries that he had. And then also we have an area where people can discuss, you know, racism. There are books for young people, and there's an opportunity that they are able to like have a discussion about this. And we look at the time period when Major Taylor was racing, you know, that he became a professional in 1896, and he would race his last professional race in 1910. And then he had a 1917 old timers race. So the years where he's racing. So we have 1896, we have Jim Crow, we have segregation, we have just his life experiences that he went through and what he detailed. And so there are various points throughout the exhibit where there is discussion that can take place about what he experienced and different things that have gone on as we were building and developing this exhibit. We start the exhibit looking at his beginnings here in Indianapolis. And we know also that he decided to leave Indianapolis. He would leave Indianapolis in 1895, and he would return as a champion. And so some of the reasons why he would leave Indianapolis. And so all of those things tell and help to tell the story of Major Taylor. And I will note that Major, in his scrapbooks, he kept a record of those things. So there's images and newspaper articles where he's clipped and put into the record of these scrapbooks of treatment from other players, treatment of where he was not able to receive accommodations. And so these were things that he was very well aware of, that he discussed and he presented out. And as he writes in his autobiography, he wanted to tell his story, and he also wanted to inspire others. So bringing that all together is something that is a part of this exhibit.
So you alluded to a discussion, an area for discussion. It is somewhat of an interactive exhibit. What will people see when they come into the museum besides this discussion area and the sort of the memorabilia that you've assembled? There are some other historical things and in the exhibit. What else will they see?
Definitely. And the discussion area is a reading nook. And there are various books there that talk about, that are about Major Taylor. But in addition, there are books that talk specifically about racism and things. So it's a reading nook where discussions can take place. And we hope that various discussions take place throughout the exhibit. But what people will see and how and ways that they are able to interact. So when you come into the exhibit, there is an introductory area. We wanted to be able to tell the story of Major, but also give an introduction to who he was. Major Taylor, champion cyclist. And we had two artists that helped to create that area. We have a poem that was written and has been recorded by the poet January York. And she gives an overview of Taylor's life, and it is a remarkable poem. And then we had an artist who did a mixed media piece, and that was done by Walter Loeb and Hamilton. And he, both of them came into the museum and used the collection to create these pieces. And so on one side, he has just numerous newspaper clippings that are from the collection, and they have different titles and highlights from Taylor's career. And that is one section. And then another section, you see different letters and Taylor's handwriting. And then you have some pieces where at least one piece where a person is writing to Major Taylor. And then the last piece, because this area is kind of created to mimic a track, and you see just different pieces and images of Major Taylor and his life. And so you get an introduction to Major, but it's definitely in a artistic presentation. You then go over to the bike shop, and the bike shop is the early experiences of Major Taylor. Again, he was born here in 1878, and he started cycling very early. He received his first bike, and then he went to a bicycle shop to get a repair done, he tells a story in his autobiography, and he performed a trick on the bike because, you know, Taylor is a cyclist and known for his speed, but also his trick riding. And he performed this trick, and then he would work at this bicycle shop. And it was the Hay and Willits bicycle shop here in Indianapolis. So we kind of start with that story and talk about also just cycling in Indianapolis, and then introduce visitors to his mentor, coach, friend, Munger, Bertie Munger. Then you can go to another section, because there's various points and directions that you can go throughout the exhibit. We come to a point where you can see riders from today. And these are riders who maybe ride for work, who are just cyclists and who enjoy. So you get to hear some audio from riders from today, local to the city, and then also images of them and different quotes. We then head over to the training room. And in the training room, you really get a sense of what Taylor's life was like as a cyclist. We talk about his regiment and his diet. And then we also talk about experiences, many of them negative that he had with various riders and when he was racing on the track. We do look at and begin with his professional debut in December of 1896 and the 6-day race. And so in that area, you're really going to have this kind of focus on Major and his experience as a cyclist. And then we have an area called the Shrine. And in the Shrine, we have one of the highlights of the exhibit, which is Major Taylor's bicycle that is on loan to us from the United States Bicycle Hall of Fame in Davis, California. And we also have two trophies that are part of the museum collection. And again, those are both from 1901. And as you go throughout the exhibit, there's another area that looks at his travel and his family life. And so as we're really looking at his family life, we have the letters and the postcards. And to add to that experience, you are able to pick up the letter or the postcard in his writing. It's just a reproduction. And then on the back, we have transcribed it, but then you can put it down on an interactive piece. And then you can hear a local artist by the name of Dominique Shelby actually read and recite and perform those pieces. And so although we do not know what Major Taylor sound like, he sounded like he gives voice to these letters. And so that's another way to engage visitors. Keeping that same experience with the postcards, we have an interactive map where individuals can pick up a postcard, and that is highlighted on a map, different places where he has gone. And then now for some of the more interactives, we have a place where you can kind of tinker with a bike and you can build your own bike. These are pieces that have come together. So there's easy, medium, and hard. And then we even have a track area where you can ride around in the exhibit. And then you can even try, and I say try because you can try to beat Major Taylor's time. We have some of his records listed out. And then we have some bicycles where you can, no matter how fast you go, you're not really going to be Major. And people can, visitors can get on the bike and they can ride around. And then there's also a hand crank bike as well that you can try to attempt to beat Major Taylor. There's a photo op and it's true to size for Major size. And then finally, there's an area where we have individuals, cyclists today, including Justin Williams, talk about the legacy and how Major Taylor has had influence on their career. And so those are different areas where you can learn about Major Taylor, his life and legacy and the inspiration, but then also engage with this kind of experience of learning about bikes and tools and different things that you need about that.
Wow, it sounds like such a comprehensive and interesting exhibit. We've been speaking with Keisha Tandy. She is the curator of state history at the State Museum of Indiana in Indianapolis. It's the Major Taylor exhibit. It sounds like a great trip you might want to make over to Indianapolis, opening today, March 5th, and once again running through
October 23rd.
So you have all spring and summer and early fall to go and see it. Keisha, thank you so much for talking with me today. I can't imagine our not getting over to Indianapolis. It's just not that far for us, and taking a day to go through this wonderful sounding exhibit. Thank you for mounting it. I think it's excellent.
Thank you so much.
All right. You have a wonderful day.
Thank you.
All righty. My thanks to Keisha Tandy for talking with me about the new exhibit at the Indiana State Museum in Indianapolis. The exhibit runs through October 23rd, and you can find out more at indianamuseum.org. Let's take a short break, and we'll be back to talk with Richard Sachs. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
Our veterans risked it all to protect our freedom. One of the best ways to say thank you is to volunteer to support them. At a time in history where kindness is a virtue, volunteering means a lot. For over 47 years, Help Heal Veterans, a not-for-profit organization, with the support of citizens like you, have delivered therapy kits to veterans who need them. To volunteer or learn more, visit HealVets.org. That's HealVets.org.
We are back on The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm Diane Jenks. It's been a while since we caught up with Richard Sachs, and I thought this might be a good time to do that. Last week, an interview on the site Tempus Fugit shed some light on more of Richard's life and about the way he thinks. Today in our conversation, we flesh out a bit more of that interview and then delve into his thoughts about what has happened in the world of frame building since the very first NABs many years ago in Austin. He and I both agree it might be time to elevate the art of frame building in an entirely new way.
Hi, Richard. Welcome back to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm glad we found some time to catch up. How are you? How have you been?
I'm well, thank you. And thank you for having me back, Diane.
No COVID issues at your house?
None at all. No.
No, us either. That's a good thing.
Yeah.
I want to talk about this interview that I read. It just popped up yesterday, Tempus Fugit. So we all know what that means. But I'm not sure in the context of what we're going to talk about, people know what it means right away. I think we're going to let listeners in on that interview because it's so interesting. Did you actually write your responses to him?
Yeah, it was an interview.
Yeah, but it wasn't an interview like you and I are having where he transcribes.
James Henderson is the man's name. The site is Tempus Fugit. I knew what it meant, but I can't remember what it means at this moment.
Time flies.
Good. There you go. So regardless, he and I kind of know each other from internet interaction because of my relationship with RGM watches and being a big, you know, independent watchmaker follower. So he kind of came into my email box about a month or two ago asking me if I would participate in an interview with him. And I said, sure. So he sent me a bunch of questions, and I'm embarrassed to say I couldn't get to them. I thought I could get to them in a week or in a few days, and he emailed me back a couple of times and prodded me, and I said, well, I just got, everything's getting lost in the clutter of my life. And I finally just sat down one day and did all the responses, and I think I edited one reply or one comment once and then just said, here it is. And, you know, he said, you know, here are the pictures that we're going to use. And are you okay with that? And I said, sure, that's cool. And he just posted it. And it's funny because like when I'm involved with stuff like this, you know, I often think, well, I wonder when it's going to launch. I wonder what it's going to look like. I wonder what the audience, who the audience will be. So every couple of days I would check his site and there would be nothing there. And I'm not the kind of guy that says, you know, like even like with this interview with you, I'm not going to say to you, hey, Diane, is this going to happen on like Saturday or next week or whatever? We simply chat. And then when it goes live, it's live. So the other day I was like trolling around on his site thinking like, I wonder when this is going to happen. And I opened it up and it was like right there. So like I wanted to compose an email and say, hey, James, this is wonderful. Thanks so much. And before I could get to the compose template, there was an email from him telling me that it just went live. So, you know, small coincidences and serendipity.
And his questions were interesting. So I'm going to urge listeners to go read it because to go through it, I'd rather they read your responses. They were very well crafted and well thought. They're very Richard. They're you. They are you.
Well, maybe when you promote whatever we're doing today, you could add a link to the...
Oh, it will be there.
Okay, cool.
No question about it. Absolutely.
It's a good site, and he's had it for quite a long time, and people are going to wonder what the connection is, but, you know, maybe they'll find out if they read the interview.
At first, I didn't know. I'm like, why is he on this site? But as soon as you read it, you figure it out. And so you mentioned the RGM watches. Let's talk about that for a moment. Did you redesign your watch recently? And tell me how you got into using a watch as one of your marketing and one of your sort of pieces of your brand.
Well, we're on Zoom now so that you can get the answers to these questions that you're asking, but I'll hold up my watch.
Anyway. There it is. Well, you know what? There is a picture I think there's a picture of it on his site, but I'll have you send it to me.
There's a whole bunch, you know, there's pictures on my site, but the short version is in the middle aughts when my racing team was between title sponsors, we had one who was with us for quite a long time and that ended. And I didn't really know what I was going to do because I didn't have the skills and the connections and the savvy and the experience that I have now. So I thought like, oh man, that's a big hole. And I didn't plan on filling it because usually these people fill it for me, meaning the people who were the previous sponsors for about 5 or 6 years. And it gets filled with money because the team needs money to run. So I thought like, okay, I'm going to put the team on eBay. And this is like not the eBay people know now. It was very different. It was the dial-up era. There was no, well, it was for me at least. I didn't have high speed or whatever it's called then. It was much more innocent than it perhaps became. And I thought like, I'm going to make an auction for my team. And whoever is the high bidder gets to be the title sponsor going forward. And there were some caveats about like what the minimum bid would be and what you get in return for the check you send, et cetera. So in the middle of all of it, we netted a title sponsor, but separate from that, Roland Murphy, the owner of RGM Watches, emailed me and wanted to know more about what this was about. And I said, well, it's all on the eBay page, but as a courtesy, you know, to the conversation, I continued with him on email, and we eventually like hooked up like the same year because he's not a rider, but he's an appreciator of like fine things and things made, let's say, to a little or no compromise standard. And he thought it would be a good relationship to align his watch company with my bike company by way of the team. So that happened, I think, beginning in 2006 and ran for a good number of years. There were 2 or 3 years in the late teens when it wasn't a thing, and then it resumed by about 2017. But after it started, one of his first motivations was to make a limited edition watch to tie the relationship together. And I think they were made in a quantity of 20 and sold out pretty quickly. And the relationship just continued. And then I think by 2014 or 2016, we spoke about doing a reissue of a higher quality watch similar to the first one that would be numbered 1 through 50 on the back and have like a different mission than the original watch was. So all these watches are like $5,000, $6,000. To begin with. And I don't know where they are now with the second watch, but I'm pretty sure they're close to numbers 40 through 50. And when they hit 50, you know, that edition will be shelved, I suppose. So, you know, that's kind of it.
Let me take a moment to reintroduce you as if you need an introduction. We're speaking with Richard Sachs, excuse me, the Richard Sachs, and there is only one. And just such a fascinating idea. The whole eBay thing is fascinating to me, that you would look at that as a possibility and then have that work out and then end up with yet another marketing idea. How about the person, and I don't really care who it was at the time, who became the title sponsor then? Did that person stick with, or did that entity stick with you, or is it somebody new now?
No, and I want to like reiterate that in 2005, my life, all life, and eBay and the internet were not what people know now. So they shouldn't, or I hope they don't like broad stroke this as some kind of like weird thing. And if they do, fuck them. So back then, the high bidder was a man who's, I'm embarrassed to say, I don't remember his full name, but the entity that he wanted to promote was Hudson Valley Velodrome, which was an idea he had for a sports complex somewhere along the Hudson, north of New York City. And it was basically still conceptual. I don't think it ever happened. Regardless, it was an idea he had, and he wanted to use our team and Cyclocross to promote it. And I hope it went well. And I don't think anything that happened with us was the reason that the velodrome didn't go forward, but in the most gentle way I can put it, it's really not my problem. So, like,
well, you don't have to be gentle. It's true. You know, you put it out there, you got what you got, he got what he got, and life moves on, right?
The thing is, that was a kind of a pivotal era for me because I work alone. I don't have a phone. I don't have any helpers who come and go. Nearly all of my business is through the mail or electronically. So I don't have people coming and disturbing me or wanting a piece of my personal space. So having my laptop near my workbench all day long back from the early zeros was a way for me to interact with people and find a voice that would not perhaps have come out otherwise, because I'd have nobody to use it with. So, you know, digitally or electronically or virtually, I found myself enmeshed in this like internet thing. And eBay was simply like one part of it. Forums were another, listservs were yet another. There was no social media. So the fact that I had the stones to put it on eBay, the team that is, was really like one of the first things I did that ultimately, I think, took me out of a shell that I lived in up until that point in my life. Because basically I still am a workaholic, and I still have no disturbances in my personal space. I have a flip phone, but no iPhone or smartphone. I don't text. And basically, I just work all day and interact with my laptop between tasks. And that's my way of expressing myself.
How do you think over these years, let's start with maybe 2005 and to now, and how the internet has changed? And even though you fundamentally haven't changed, it's changed the world of cycling and it's changed the world of conversation. And you seem to have been able to sort of slip in and out of that world and not have it disturb who you are fundamentally. So are you affected by or influenced by anything that's going on out there?
On the internet?
Well, in our industry specifically, but in the internet in general.
I'm not in your industry.
No, I'm not in my industry either. I meant the bicycle world.
Well, let me rephrase that. The industry, I live outside of it. I live in the margins, as perhaps you do. I have felt that way at least since the middle to late 80s. And a lot of the people that I shuck and jive with on the internet now were not in the trade then. A lot of them weren't even born then. So for me to like have this conversation and like bullet point the fact that like I feel like I'm an outlier, I think a lot of people wouldn't even know what are you talking about? You make bikes, you get paid to make bikes. How could you say you're not in the industry? Well, I'm saying it, and it's not something I started saying last week. I have like, it might be too strong a word, but I have such contempt for the industry compared to the way it once was that I simply have to like meter out my anxiety if I feel it coming on, and you know maybe rein it back a few steps.
What's changed that brought on this contempt? Besides the fact that, and let me just flesh out that question a little bit. When frame building was at its height in my mind, when it was the real deal, and that's where ideas came from, the industry looked at frame building for ideas. Now it seems that's been flipped on its head. And I don't know what they're doing. Everything is carbon and everything is disc and everything is all of these things that I don't necessarily agree with, which puts me outside the industry in a lot of ways. So is that where the contempt comes from?
Well, I don't know. I saw it changing as perhaps, I guess, a 30-something. I'd been in the business for 10 or 12 years. I never really had heroes or muses But I did have a deep respect for the people who came before me, who were accomplished, successful, innovative, and whatnot. Whatnot is probably the most important part of that. But what I noticed, and I apologize, Diane. I can't find a way to say this without sounding a bit like a jerk. But when the bike industry became the mountain bike industry by the middle to late 80s, and you remember that because most people don't remember life without a mountain bike in the industry. To its credit, the product line changed everything and got more people on bikes and saved a lot of local bike shops because people were not buying road bikes. But the community and the vibe and the makers and the manufacturers and the business mores that came with the changes that mountain biking, off-road riding introduced into the larger picture, or when things started going sideways. Most of the men or most of the people that I knew who were before me, their sons didn't want to take over their businesses. Their sons didn't even want to like work, you know, they wanted a white collar job, not a trade. So little by little frame building, you know, which is what I know more than anything, started to change because nobody was continuing it. So by the early to middle 90s, like everything was mountain bike centric. And the end of the Cold War also introduced a lot of manufacturers to the sporting goods industry who previously were making weapons, and they needed to find some way to keep the machinery going. So they would start making like CNC hubs or stems, or veer into like mass-produced welded frames or whatever it was, because they had all the machinery and they had the workforce. They just had to start diversifying. So, you know, that period might have taken 10 or 15 years, but when it finally ran its course, I think it changed the landscape of road cycling or road bicycles completely. And, you know, I was still young at that point, but I was thinking, God, like there's nobody left. And like, frame building is dead. And like, this was like middle to late 90s. And it essentially was, because everybody who was in Europe was selling their brand or going out of business, or they're closing their shop because their children didn't want it. So I don't think I'm making a lot of sense here. So I have to like stop myself for a second. But the changes that came as a result of like the move from pavement to dirt also brought with it improvements in manufacturing, improvements in networking, improvements in material technologies, and a lot of things that may never have happened otherwise. Because the road bike scene then wasn't exactly like fully innovative. They were simply making things lighter, but they weren't really going outside their own boxes to improve too much. And in the wake of it all, the maker industry or the maker side of things simply started to vaporize.
Yeah, but all of that said, you have stuck with a very specific process, making a very specific product that has never waned in popularity as long as I can remember.
Yeah, thank you for that. I agree. Part of it is that while my background somehow brought me to the front door of the trade almost by accident, or completely by accident, and I didn't really want to be a bike maker. I simply became one eventually. I wanted other things, and I kept thinking throughout the first 10 or 15 years of my life that like, okay, if I've had it with this bullshit, like I'm going to like, quote unquote, go back to school, or in reality, start school, because I never did go to college. And I always thought of myself as like a sidetracked student who wanted to write, or thought he wanted to write when he was a scholastic aged young person. And that was this like little thought bubble I carried around with myself, thinking like, I don't have to keep doing this. And eventually, like, the years take off. I have a lot of bikes in the world, and more people ordering them. And I'm thinking like, geez, I actually have a thing here. And I didn't really believe that I knew as much as people perhaps thought I did, but it was the gig and people were paying me. And I kind of thought like, well, I can simply just improve over time. And little by little, you either improve or you don't. And I feel like I have exponentially. However, I eventually let go of that side of myself that thought like, okay, like I've had it. I'm going to start going to school. I'm going to learn to be a writer or focus on that. And then like I said, like, I'm fooling myself. Like, I might have had a skill as an 18-year-old to write well. You know, I was funneled into schools that would help me develop that. I didn't get into any of them. I eventually like reapplied to other schools and got into them, and I couldn't start for like various reasons that are too complicated to get into here. And I simply like fell into the bike thing. But I kept trying to think, I have the chops. And then I realized, no, I didn't have the chops. If I went to college, I would have like, you know, been there for the drugs and the relationships, because that was the time for people of my age, at least. And college was simply a place, it was like the delivery system for fun rather than a place of learning. Because like, I was a shit student no matter what school I was in. The fact that I kind of latched onto this writing thing at Petty was, in my opinion, just one more serendipitous event that worked in my favor.
So you need to, just so that you understand what Richard's talking about, you need to read the interview in Tempus Fugit, which again, you will find a link to on our blog when this posts this weekend. Let's take a short break. And when we come back, we're going to talk with Richard Sachs some more. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. We are back on The Outspoken Cyclist. If you're just joining me, I am speaking with the Richard Sachs. And when did you decide to add the to your name, to your brand? Not to your name, but to your brand. And maybe why?
That's a pretty funny question, because I didn't do that at all. It's just that my email address, or one of my two email addresses, is therichardsachs@gmail. And back in the zeros or the aughts, when all the kids, actually they weren't kids, they were maybe like 8 or 10 years younger than I was at the time, that were racing with me or for me on the cyclocross team, many of them had already had Gmail accounts. And their email addresses were the, with their names after it. And I don't want to tell anybody's name on the interview for fear of
retribution
or embarrassment, or like, you know, it doesn't matter. So if we had like the John Doe or the Mary Jones, you know, they all had email addresses. So we basically like stayed in touch via email, even though it was the beginning of the high speed internet era and the beginning of Gmail. So when I finally switched from Juno to Gmail, it was the Richard Sachs. So like, you know, it's funny, like you would even like think about that as a thing. And like, I had never thought about it. It was just like, I had all these kids. So like I said, these, you know, young adults who I hung around with for the cross season, and their Gmail addresses were their name preceded by the word the.
I've never heard that. That is hilarious. Okay. I mean, you know, I'm thinking, wow, what a cool idea, because it so sets you apart in some ways. Everybody uses a name like me dot Jones, yeah, or whatever, you know.
I totally get it. And, you know, that's one of the things that I find using my long lens is that, you know, folks often, attribute or give me credit for something that they think is, I don't know, clever or different. And I don't really deserve that. This example is one of those. I appreciate it, but there's really not a lot going on here, Diane.
Let's take it. We're going to switch gears a little bit here because it's not a question I would normally ask, but it's about what's going on around the world. And you know, people are complaining bitterly about the price of gas. And you know, I felt that gas has been too cheap forever. You know, we subsidize the oil industry and it's ridiculous. I mean, if anybody has ever been in Europe, they know they pay a hell of a lot more money for gas. So I'm wondering what your thoughts are and how you see it may or may not turn people back into using other forms of transportation, including a bicycle.
Well, in America, it's going to take a lot more than the Putin versus Ukraine thing to make that happen. Because I, to use the word again, I find in a lot of cases there's such contempt for cyclists on the road from people who have to get someplace more quickly than they can because you're kind of in the way for a brief moment. I don't think it's going to happen in my lifetime. And I mean, when I go on like social media and I see people talking about like, oh, in Holland they do this, or in like Milan there's like a dedicated you know, bikeway for that, or God knows what. It's like, great, but like, we're not them. And we will never be them. And like using them as an example is not going to further the cause. I don't know what it's going to take, but one would think that with all the accidents and fatalities that you could read about that involve like a vehicle and a bike and a rider, someplace, some politician or some civic movement would rise up and say, like they say in Network, I'm mad as hell and I'm not going to take it anymore. I don't have an answer to your question. I think it's sadly every man for himself until further notice.
Yeah. All right. We'll switch gears again. Looks like some of the shows are coming back. You thinking of going back to Philly or out to Sacramento? You haven't been to NABS in a long time. So
I stopped going to NABS when they were in Denver. So I did 9 straight and then I kind of pulled the plug.
Yeah.
Being a show, I didn't go this past year, even though I paid for a booth after the most recent one ended. For 2021, my personal feeling was that the time with the COVID thing was still not done, and that going into a big room with a bunch of people wearing masks, even if the spacing was better, is not the aesthetic that I think I want to be part of. I'll also say that going back to NABS, at least 2 through 9, because those are the ones I went to the first one, but that was a completely different animal.
Right.
I've never been a Rose and Isles guy. So the whole like convention center trade show aesthetic to me is like, Jesus, like I'm not Trek, I'm not Schwinn, I'm not Shimano, I'm not, a clothing company. Yet all of the vestiges of a trade show are evident at these smaller shows. And I keep thinking like, there's gotta be a better way to do this. And I don't wanna use the word classy, but that's what.
I love it. So what would that be, Richard? What would be a better way to highlight the artisan nature of frame building and what goes into it? Because it does, it doesn't just consist of the frame builder. It consists of the suppliers of tubing and lugs and dropouts and all bottom, all of those things, paint.
I'm one of those suppliers.
Yeah, you are. Good point.
That's a loaded question, because if we want to unravel this story and go back to the beginnings, NABS was not designed for that. NABS was designed to be a collegial weekend of like-minded, experienced and inexperienced frame builders who could somehow, you know, attach themselves to everybody else in the same space for a couple of nights, trade stories, give advice, pass out business cards, and figure out better ways to do what we all do. It's just that once it became successful, all the manufacturers wanted a part of it. So little by little, I was like on, I think, 8 or maybe 9 different insider panels deciding like which direction things go. And by the end, very little went the way I thought it should. So that kind of was my catalyst for leaving. But it's like, they want to be part of it. And then eventually they want to take over because they have so much money. They want to buy 3 booths and they want to have this location. And people lose sight of the fact that this is really for independent people who are essentially like not struggling, but, you know, most frame builders don't make a lot of money. They might after a certain point in time, years at the bench or units produced, but the rank and file frame builder is still trying to figure out how to run his business. And when you have all these like corporate behemoths, like all around you at the shows, it really changes the vibe. So I don't agree that like these other people should be there. So to answer your question, the places that I've been that have been like beautiful and have put out a good vibe have been gallery shows. I mean, you don't hear about that because like if I displayed an art gallery in Connecticut or someplace else in New York City, that community is the one that self-promotes it. And it doesn't really cross over into like a Velo News article or a social media article from, I don't know, the Radovist. I kind of think that frame building, regardless of the differences between the then and the now, is not like part of like the bigger industry and shouldn't be enmeshed in a room full of other people trying to like put whatever hustle they can on you as you walk by their booth. So I'm really like, you know, I'm not as bitter as it might sound, but I kind of think like the trade lost its way and it doesn't really know what to do with itself now. And I gave a lot of advice and tried to inspire as many people as I could for as long as I could. But I'm kind of on the other side of that now. And if somebody asks, you know, I'll give them an opinion. But for the most part, it's somebody else's life to save now, not mine.
I look at what you're saying. There used to be something here in Cleveland called the May Show. Mm-hmm. And it allowed anyone who was either born in Ohio or who lives in Ohio who was an artist. And you didn't have to attend the Cleveland Institute of Art or any of the local Oberlin or anything like that to submit 2 pieces of work for a juried show. And it's gone, and it's been gone. And to me, that's what highlighted a local artist or an artisan whose work needed to be viewed by the public in a gallery type setting. And that's what it was. And so when you said gallery show, that's what I heard as something that would elevate frame building to a different kind of thinking.
That's kind of where I'm at too. And like when we started doing the NAB stuff, I say we, because the conversation always included me and Walker and a couple of other people, his inner circle. And a lot of us were the ones feeding the ideas. It was simply Walker's entity. So my perspective then, and we're talking now like 2005, 2006, before the whole thing had a head of steam. Back then, my wife, Deb, was a nationally renowned basket maker, hand weaver, and reproduction artist of period correct fabrics and, things. I apologize. I can't think of any word to use. And the shows that she would go to were, like you said, they were juried shows. And a lot of them were really high-class acts. One of them, for me, when it was in Valley Forge, was the template that I wanted to use for the bike shows that we had in San Jose and Portland and Indianapolis. And it was basically this. The promoter back then was a man named Bob Goodrich. And on Friday night, it was by invitation only. It was nice clothing, dress up, hors d'oeuvres and drinks were served. And he had a way to get people into the arena at Valley Forge with craftspeople from around the country and essentially like whet their appetite so that they would stand there longer and want to be more engaging with the people who had a booth there, or booths. Saturday and Sunday, you know, everything was a little different and you didn't have to get dressed up and they didn't serve, you know, the canopies and the wine and whatnot. And the price to go that day was quite different. So Bob Goodrich's show, or shows, I mean, I only know the ones that he produced at Valley Forge, were my baptism into hot shows.
Gallery openings, and that's how they work.
And the other thing that I thought was really cool, and I insisted we do this, was that you can't bring a camera in. Nobody had iPhones back then, okay? So he wanted to control the narrative completely, which by itself might sound a little bit like, you know, weird. I personally thought it was brilliant. Any press that comes out of the 3 days at the show comes from the photographers that the show hires to expose the craftspeople.
And the media people that they bring in.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And then when we were going into, I think, San Jose 1, or maybe it was San Jose 2, I don't remember. But that was one of the things that I said, look, we got to do this. This is the way to get things done. This is the way to have the best possible exposure and not a lot of schlock out there from people who think they're doing you a favor by blogging about it. Because even then, blogging was in its infancy. You want to like have your finger on everything, period. So I sold that. And then what happened was, by the time the first day opened, I guess it would have been a Friday because they didn't have like Friday night openings, people were taking pictures and like everybody was walking around saying, no, you can't take pictures. And there were signs saying like no photographs, no cameras. And like, it just stopped working. It was like, it was kind of like we had this fantasy or this ideal, and in its conceptual form, it was perfect. But in reality, we just didn't have the manpower or the stones to enforce it. And little by little, I mean, this is not part of the story of the Bob Goodrich Productions, but little by little, like a clothing company wants to be part of the scene. A hub maker wants to be part of the scene. Shimano wants to be part of the scene. And like the whole complexion just changed everything over a few years. And it kind of like eventually got under my skin and I had to like do an about face. But in essence, the gallery concept is what I think frame building needs to keep itself highbrow.
Exactly. People don't, well, that's another topic, the idea of whether a frame builder is an artist or not. I believe that he or she is. That there is an art as well as, you know, the craft.
Let me apologize for like interrupting, but I think that with the exception of like people that have companies that make, you know, like 1,000 frames a year, or, you know, like have 6 people working there, most frame building entities are like one man shops or one woman shops. And they're essentially still trying to figure it out like 20 years into the business, if they even make it that long. So I think of that as art in a way. It may not be art like, you know, a painting or a piece of sculpture is an art, but it is definitely a human being fighting with convention to make something unique and beautiful against all odds. In other words, the bike industry wants you to buy a Trek for $14,000 or a Canyon for something else, or like a Cervelo, because, you know, that's what Wood Fan Art wins on, or Marianne Vos.
Right.
Frame building is up against that, whether it wants to admit it or not. I'm a big fan of the idea that racing improves the breed. I've always felt that way. That's a quote from Mr. Honda. I forget how to pronounce his first name. He said that many, many generations ago. And that doesn't mean a frame builder has to race, but I do feel like the sport is where you can't lie or hide. And even if you don't make racing bicycles, it is the proving ground. So I kind of feel like now that Signard and Burke and all those other people own the sport, it's really hard for a frame builder to kind of get into the peloton and find a way to test his ideas. I could live forever and I will never let go of that feeling that there needs to be a tie-in. I mean, I have a racing team and I come from a racing background, but I'm not saying that that's what people need to do or have. But so to simply take a bunch of pipes and some gas tanks and oxygen and try to braise things up and say, this is my vehicle, I still think there's something missing there, but it certainly wouldn't hurt to have those things in galleries in the meantime.
As always, it's so much fun to talk with you. I wish I could just do this all day. Are you doing anything new for 2022? Or I don't know what the queue is like these days. I don't know exactly. I mean, your racing team is out there racing, doing well.
Oh, yeah. Well, the queue, the famous or infamous queue that I had going through the zeros and most of the teens, that ended in 2017, I think. I finally caught up to the last name. I took a little breather. I hit the reset button. And ever since then, you know, I take maybe 10 or 12 months of work in at a given time. And when I see that I have, 40 or 50 orders in front of me, which is essentially what I could do per year, I say, that's it. And then I put a note on my site, because I still believe in websites, saying like, you know, watch this page, because until I get to the end of the current list, I can't take any more orders. And I've done that, five times already since 2018. And almost at the end of all my commitments from 2021, obviously it's March and I have run over a bit. So I haven't taken in new work yet. And I have a few handshake and best friend forever orders to fill. And yeah, so like I'm not retired. I have like no designs on like changing the pace of making here. I simply keep it on the down low, because for a while there I was simply taking any order that people wanted to place, give me a small deposit, a couple $100 and a signature, and I'll call you when I get to your name. And eventually I suffocated on information saving. And eventually like got to the end of that. And that was like the most beautiful thing in my adult life, to not have any single commitments, period. So that's how I run my business, you know, for the frame building. The shops, I still sell like all the lugs and tubing that Dario and I designed. At this point, it's like a long time ago, but we revised it so many times through the years that, you know, the tubing is still current. I do that pretty regularly, and the racing team runs itself. To answer your question, my alignment, I'll use that word, my alignment with House Industry is as strong as ever, and they just finished designing all the graphics and kits and paint colors and ancillary things for the 2022 team. We don't really make that stuff public until like a week before the race. So I just started seeing those finished things a couple of days ago. So I'm really excited for that. At this moment, I'm making a bunch of team frames. And, you know, that's my life this week.
That's my life this week.
Yeah.
What a great conversation. We've been speaking with Richard Sachs, We will post the information about the interview he did with Tempest Fugit on our site. I hope you enjoyed the conversation as much as I did, Richard. It's always good to catch up with you.
Likewise. Hey, thanks for calling again, and my best to you and Brian, and stay safe and healthy, and get out on your bike as soon as you can.
My thanks to Richard Sachs for joining me on the show today. It's always good to catch up with him and hear his perspectives on his craft. My thanks to Keisha Tandy for taking us through the Major Taylor exhibit in Indianapolis. For those of you who contacted me about my conversation with frame builder Dmitry Nechayev, thank you for your support and for your concerns. As the war in Ukraine rages on, there are many pleas for help, not only from Dmitry, but also others looking to get out of Russia and also support their families. Please visit the Outspoken Cyclists Facebook page for information and updates. I'm working on some news stories for upcoming episodes, so please remember to subscribe to the podcast on your favorite app, and you'll get notices every time a new episode drops. Go to OutspokenCyclist.com for show notes, photos, and links, and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I hope you have a great week. Please stay safe, stay well, keep Ukraine in your thoughts and intentions. Till next time, bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Jenks. We welcome your thoughts and contributions on our Facebook page, or visit OutspokenCyclist.com to leave a comment on any episode. We will be back next week with new guests, topics, conversations, and news from the world of cycling. Subscribe to the show on your favorite podcast app and you'll never miss an episode. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU-FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.